You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 6th of April, 2022, approaching the Feast of the Annunciation. You may hear canines in the background. When I got married, I inherited two, now get this, hairless rat terriers. Now, they're the cutest things you could ever see. But since the last time we spoke, I adopted, I had another cat adopted me. This is one of the tortoise shells, the one that has a line down the middle of its face and everything. Beautiful cat. They're almost always female. There's a very rare male tortoise shell. And I've told you before that Stanley is, you know, the bottom of his class, coming from wherever they train MI6 agents in Britain. I have the feeling that this is a very different kind of cat. She's only been here a few days. She's very tiny and a rescue. And one of the first things she does in front of everybody is go and eat the dog's food, which is a pretty, you know, it's a power move from a cat's point of view. But it was today, I think, that, you know, the biggest, you know, it's like when you go to jail, you find the biggest guy. That's what she did. This roly-poly dog, absolutely harmless and docile and passive, like a Great Dane. Absolutely, you couldn't hurt a fly if it wanted to. This cat had this poor guy cornered in the laundry room with its, you know, beating it with its paw. It's like two people playing tennis. Just, you know, that sound. And last I checked, he's still in there. As far as I know, legend has it, he'll be in there for a very long time, will not make eye contact with this feline. And so now we know who rules the house. So unlike Stanley, who is just a useless MI6 agent, this cat definitely is GRU, and I believe she is here to protect me from whoever is trying to hurt me today, which I'm sure there is a large number of people. So that's my news. And, you know, there's something else. There's something going on in Ukraine, too. But that's my big news for the week. And, I appreciate all of my supporters on Patreon. This is a big deal. A lot of people have actually, since, you know, the PayPal thing, people are using Patreon to donate. You know, that you can make a one-time donation there and then cut it back as you get billed every month. There's also been some confusion. You have seen both on my website, rustjournal.org, as well as on my main page on the blog that Sven set up for me, that you could find right on the Radio Albion page. There's a blue icon with a double eagle on it, and it says, "Support the Orthodox Medievalist." That is me. I think there was some confusion there, because it doesn't say nationalist. The website is the Orthodox Medievalist. And lastly, I want to point out that my P.O. box, if you don't like the electronic stuff, you could send, please make it American currency. Some generous soul did send me Canadian dollars, which I still have. People think that banks are going to change it for you. They won't. I appreciate that, but I still have it. They're like, I'm using them as bookmarks now. Anyway, my P.O. box is 304, and that's Tire Hill, Pennsylvania. Tire, as in the tire on your car. And that's 15959. So if you want to do it that way, I would appreciate it. Now, it isn't so much that I've got tired of the Ukraine situation. I've been dealing with Ukraine. In fact, if you go back to my archives, going back to the Voice of Reason, I think it was 2009 when I first got started here, my very first lecture was entitled Ukraine at the Door of the Fourth World. I did something then on Peter the Great, and then I did something on Brezhnev. I think those are the first three things I did. Situation in Ukraine here is not shocking to me. The nuclear issue, the biological issue, the colonial, the new, it's all, you know, neo-colonialism. It's not this direct dominance like the French or the British or the Dutch had, the Portuguese had. This is a indirect financial dominance. And one good example of this is Aramco. Aramco, the Saudi state-owned oil company. I forget where I did this, but I went through everyone on the board there. And yes, they have suitably Arabic-sounding names. But something tells me they don't keep Ramadan, because every one of these people are educated in America. You know, Colorado State and Harvard and NYU. And of course, they all speak English. Some of them speak English as their first language. Now, recently, because of the American failure everywhere, you know, militarily, financially, they are becoming more independent. But this is how colonialism is laid out today. You know, imperialism, this kind of thing, is this, there's an emotional punch to it. It isn't inherently evil. And the difference between, say, Russia's former control over Ukraine or the Baltics or Central Asia and the empires of Britain or the Netherlands or even much older ones, you know, even going back to Phoenicia and Tyre and Carthage. The difference is one is defensive and the other is commercial. That's the big difference. Russia's empire was never a profitable enterprise. Russia's empire was defending its humongous land border from enemies, specifically, many centuries ago, Poland, then later Great Britain, and now the United States. But when you're redefining colonialism to such an extent that the color revolution, and I've been through this too, every leader of every color revolution, and even some of their immediate underlings, speak fluent English, were educated in America to a man, and are far more American in their day-to-day life than whatever, you know, Georgian or Syrian or, you know, Cantonese Hong Kong or Tibet or whatever. And so when these people take over, you have more or less an indirect control, and especially over the banking system. If you control the banking system, we all know, you control the economy. And if you control the economy, you control the country. Now, that explanation I've given 1,000 times. And back when this started, I've been doing this since the early 90s. This is 2009. I began this project, you know, the Orthodox Medievalist and the Orthodox Nationalist and whatever else it was called. And that became the core of it. Nationalism is the opposite of imperialism. And that the only reason that imperialism is a bad thing is that it trammels the rights of nations. You know, the left has always, and even the neocons have always made the claim that the nation doesn't exist, certainly not as an ethnic or a racial or even a cultural entity. They will not make that argument. But if that's true, then there can't be anything wrong with imperialism. If we're all the same under the skin, if we're all identical ciphers, the mass man consuming and producing, then colonialism isn't a problem. What difference does it make where the border is? In fact, if there's no borders at all, and that's the demand, then how can you even rationally talk about colonialism or imperialism? Ukraine, starting from, let's say, 2004, and then to an extreme degree in 2014, is a hybrid version of both. I mean, there is a direct control when the financing and the military apparatus, despite its Soviet foundation, comes from Western powers. And really, when you say NATO, you mean the United States. You've seen the defense ministry of other NATO members. You have non-military men. You have people with no military experience. You have minimal military spending because they know the Americans are going to do the bulk of the fighting anyway. I think those days are over. But that's what it comes down to. And that's why it's not so much being bored of it. It's just that everything that's happening now, I've been talking about in a sometimes even in a military sense, for a very long time. This show, although it deals with that stuff all the time, my Patreon tends to be more practical essays. this lecture series from the beginning has been more theoretical. And the concept of theory is, you know, facts don't stand by themselves. You can't list facts and have that mean anything. Facts only exist when they are part of an overarching theory. The whole always comes before the parts. That's the foundation of realism with a capital R, and the foundation of any kind of nationalism. You know, the nation is just one more archetype. And so we have dealt with those kind of foundations. Facts only exist when they are part of a broader whole. And the concept of the whole coming before the parts has been a touchstone of Eastern, meaning Eastern European, philosophy for a long time. And last week I spent an hour talking about Simeon Frank, the Jewish convert to Orthodoxy in 1919, thrown out of the Soviet Union on the philosopher's ship, and was a contemporary of Berdyaev. Berdyaev died in 1948. Frank died in 1950. So this is part of the same generation. And I think, and the, you know, I've dealt with so many people on this series over the years that should have a much broader audience than they have. You know, if you get a PhD in political theory like me, you end up going through the same list of people. It vaguely starts at Plato, goes through, you know, Aristotle and, you know, Plotinus and almost, you know, St. Augustine, Aquinas, and then it skips really most of the Middle Ages because it refuses to deal with theology at all, except for Augustine. And then you get into the Renaissance, you get into Hobbes, and then Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau. Machiavelli is usually in there. Depending on who you read, the founder of modernity is either, Leo Strauss would say it was Machiavelli, Michael Oakeshott, myself, so many others will say that it's Thomas Hobbes, but they're overlapping to a great extent. And you end up roughly with Nietzsche and a few of the important figures, you know, Lenin and, you know, all that from Rosenberg from the 20th century. Problem there, that's called the canon. And the problem there is that it skips over a massive number of people, usually on the right of the political spectrum, because the canon is written to marginalize people. The whole point of this canon, this is what political theory is, and you list a bunch of names, with a few exceptions. Edmund Burke, I say Hegel, but with a handful of exceptions, and of course in the ancient world these distinctions don't matter, proposes a view of world history starting from the primitive and then moving to the advanced, which is very simplistic, which the Eurasians, you know, Alexander Dugin, myself, so many others, have spent their entire lives fighting against this progress. No one can tell me where the engine comes from, the fuel, or warfare, whatever it is. The revolutions of the modern and the postmodern era, color revolutions included, have all been means whereby this spirit has worked itself out. Now, nowhere do you have more marginalized but brilliant men in this field than in Russia and then the dissidents of the Soviet Union. We're in an era, whether it be the USSR decades ago or the USA today, where being a Samizdat dissident is seeing this huge flowering of political ideas. The problem with us, though, is that we don't really have much of a tradition. You know, the U.S. is a much later artificial federation of nations rather than nation in and of itself, despite the ethnic background of the Founding Fathers, although that didn't really matter with Shays' Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion, which was Celt against Anglo. But despite all that, you know, the tradition is some kind of Roman Republic kind of idea. The only real traditional, only real kind of, for lack of a better term, conservative early figure would be John Adams. And the fight between who supported the French Revolution and who rejected it. In Russia, however, you have a tradition going back, it's Byzantium, Eastern Europe, Bulgaria, and it's a primordial tradition. And there's a reason why these figures have been forgotten about. I don't want to say, you know, overtly banned, although every once in a while some idiot journalists will talk about Ivan Ilyin as if they know anything. Yet these people have not read a syllable of, you know, Dugin or Ilyin or any of these people, but they claim that they are ruling Putin's mind, and this is, you know, they throw words around. They don't know the difference between communism and fascism. They have no conception. That's not what they're for. But other than that, you don't hear about these people. The set of assumptions that they make about the world, the approach to reality, doesn't have an anchor in much of the Western world. Part of the modern and postmodern project has been to destroy any sense of the past, or at least any sense of the past that they haven't filtered. And I think last week we ended up the idea that the individual, which is taken for granted, you know, the individual by itself is an abstraction. It's a myth. The only individuals that matter are those with billions of dollars, and even they struggle to get their point across. Without, of course, media manipulation. Without media, there isn't anything. That's the nature of postmodern America. But the idea that any specific individual, as ignorant as we all are, just as people, can only manifest, can only talk about, can only experience, can only deal with a tiny aspect of what is. There's an entire Russian school of thought, and people like Berdyaev did not like, and it was called the intuitivists, or they were called the intuitivists. And the concept, and I've dealt with this I don't know how many times before, but it's something that Americans sometimes don't grasp because there is no real vocabulary to grasp it. I had to teach myself Russian many years ago because I began to realize that language is very important. When you have a much more ancient language, it's manifesting far more complex things. And in today, 2022, everything has been so dumbed down, has been so simplified, that meanings of terms, as I've said this before, even in, you know, the colonial era, has no bearing on what a term's meaning might be today. Simeon Frank was one of these intuitivists. And the idea, it's not really an assumption, it's almost an axiom, that whenever you talk about anything in particular, including what I'm talking about right now, you do it against the background of everything else. An A is only an A. An object is only an object, because it's been taken out of a far greater, almost an infinite whole. That any kind of logical abstraction, I mean, that's what logic is. The very fact I use the word X or A or object rather than a specific thing is an abstraction. But it exists because there is this primordial unity where the whole always comes before the parts. A part is only a part because it comes from something. A part of what? The term doesn't make any sense. Still, in Frank's mind, logic only applies to a piece of being. The Western positivist idea in liberalism, nominalism, kind of assumes that everything is quantitative. And they go even farther than that and say, the only thing that can possibly exist is that which can be reduced to quantity, numbers, votes, dollars, opinion polls, you know, whatever can be reduced to numbers. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. Which, by the way, is a completely non-scientific statement, as Leo Strauss demonstrated over and over again. But this not A, this everything else, is not purely quantitative. It contains both a rational and an irrational element. And by that I mean, you know, rational being logical. It has to do with determination. You know, A causes B. B causes C, therefore A causes C. The irrational, I shouldn't say irrational, the subrational or the non-rational is where freedom comes from. His famous book, The Unfathomable, is his book on theology where he deals with this to a great extent. But these kind of abstractions only exist because there is this greater unity. The very fact that you can abstract from something and leave everything else implies that this makes sense. And the everything else guarantees that. Now, even Arthur Schopenhauer, who I know many of you are familiar with, assumes that our desiring wills, we all see the same thing, colored by desire, of course, only because the structure of reason is the same with each person. That, in fact, guarantees this world projection. A exists only because it comes from everything else, the not A. one exists only without the other. Now, this everything, which really can't put a word to, but just, you know, for lack of a better term, we call it the all, the everything. This is not a being in our normal sense of the term. It's not subject to the law of contradiction. The law of contradiction only exists with the part of things, never the whole. Because the whole, then, by definition, would have to incorporate both the A and the not A at the same time. All that's new, all that we can perceive, any new knowledge that we gather, does not come from this definite ground in the sense that everything is based on cause and effect. I've been through this 1,000 times before. Things come from not just things that can be logically designated, but from things that can't be logically designated. We have this idea both in Hegel and Schelling, so I've dealt with, I don't think on this show, but many other places, of what the nature of the subconscious is. For Hegel and his conception of psychoanalytics, the mysterious, the things that we don't quite know, is found in the subconscious. The more things are, like Heidegger would say, more things are unveiled, the more things come out of subconsciousness and into consciousness. Now, the idea of knowledge is to remove the subconscious altogether. But it's important, and this is what Frank calls the transfinite essence. Things that we perceive and we come to know over time don't just come from stuff that's logical and quantitative, it also comes from its opposite. A plus X, so to speak. Any object can only partly and partially be based on determinate things, indeterminate logic. The Unfathomable is written in 1939. Knowledge doesn't come from that which is purely logical. It comes from things that are unknown and beyond knowledge, not merely something that's some definite ground, some logical foundation where we go from A to B. The subconscious is beyond all of this. And I said last week, his understanding of God, you hear these dogs back there? These understandings of God are found in the idea of consciousness. And I said this last time. Consciousness isn't really an object, but it's something we experience. We can't not experience it. We could not experience many things. But even in not experiencing something, we are conscious of it in one form or another. Consciousness isn't an object, but it contains all other objects. We're aware of its freedom. We're aware of the fact that this consciousness that we all possess can contain everything we come across, and God knows how much more. And this is extremely important to understand. From here, he builds the argument for God. That what in heaven's name is this consciousness? What kind of object is it? It is, for all purposes, it's infinite. It can contain anything. We could study astronomy. It can contain anything without itself being concrete. If we're studying a concrete object, you know, we're studying planets or stars or rocks, the consciousness that approaches these things can't also be a concrete thing. It has to be non-concrete. It has to be spiritual by definition, or the study of anything doesn't make any sense. So he's talking about universal reality, both in the internal sense and in the external sense, and at least for our internal sense, is purely a spiritual matter. But if you want to talk about consciousness as this infinite spiritual matter that we all contain, well, the next question is, where the heck does it come from? So what's the point of all this? The point of all this is that this is the foundation of what some will call the perennial philosophy, which is another way of saying that ontology conditions everything. Natural law, and if you have a natural law ethics as I do, it implies that there is a state of affairs that come before our choosing, our acting, our thinking, and therefore conditions it. And if we want to fight it, well, that's the very definition of perversion. The root of perversion is to turn away. To turn away from this ground of being. This is why all civilizations that have ever existed have had the family, the extended family, have been repulsed at homosexuality, have had a religious foundation, had an aesthetics, had a sense of realism in the Platonic sense. There's an aesthetic background to everything. They've had sports. They've had a cast of warriors, a cast of clergy. Many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. This, therefore, is based not on the free actions of individuals, but free actions have to be based on something. Actions towards what and for what purpose? This is what the war against the French Revolution was based on. Free action in and of itself, to the extent that this is possible in the libertarian sense, doesn't make sense unless you, first of all, explain the ground of your action, and second of all, the purpose of your action. But at the same time, and we talked about Heidegger briefly the last time, that objects don't exhaust things. Objects are merely sets of meanings. And sets of meanings are far more important than objects, but still, these meanings have to arise from something objective. Civilization upon civilization, civilizations that have had no contact with each other, have a very distinctive structure. The Faustian idea, which is at war with this perennial concept. Prometheanism. I always know that Prometheus and Set in Egypt are connected. And that's the archetype for Satan. Then you have mechanization, which is based on nominalism. And then Darwinism and Freudianism. And it's no accident. I mean, Freud came afterwards. But speaking of imperialism, you can't have imperialism without some conception, in the modern sense, without some conception of Darwinism. And Darwin had this very vague understanding of reality, which came from alchemy, that all things are dead. There is this single dead matter that connects everything. It's one, it's a monistic thing that over time, due to conflict and everything else, environment, morphs from one being to another as they conform to their environment, struggles and everything else. That is not what we're talking about here. The secrets of nature, in that sense, the philosopher's stone is to reach this nothing, which is the same thing as a Kabbalistic ensof, the flux. And from the flux, you can create anything. So if evolutionism is allegedly this blind natural development, man having some conception of reason that's above all this can find out what the mechanism is and then make it work consciously rather than subconsciously. Now, there are two sides to that coin. Frank makes the argument, and I don't know how you could really fight it rationally. But if there are no means, I mean, think of the materialist idea, the Marxist idea, much of the liberal idea, which are based on a very crude mechanism. If you even want to assume that mechanism, this cause and effect, is the only thing that exists, then you can't make any truth claims, including that. If there's no way to rise above mechanistic causality, then you can't talk about truth. You can't solve problems. And this is why naturalism, which is so dominant in the West for a long time, is self-refuting. Because you can't even talk about it unless you take for granted a spiritual reality from which you can analyze all of these things abstractly. Science, of course, deals only with abstractions. I don't care what era you're in. It doesn't deal with objects. It doesn't deal with things. It deals with things like heat, you know, force, whatever. Those aren't objects. And that's sort of a double-edged sword. And that's kind of what Frank is talking about here, although in a very different sense. Truth can't be the product of mechanism because it implies that consciousness can't get beyond it. And therefore can't look at it objectively, and therefore can't tell if it's real or not. Whatever you say is just the result of a ancient causal chain. many of you are aware of this argument, but people take it for granted, including intellectuals. In fact, you may even consider it the official ideology. We talked about what the pentagram is. The pentagram is a five, you know, is a star with five points. The top point is by itself. The four are the four elements of the world. Four corners. In other words, everything that is logical, everything that is quantitative, matter. But then the point on the top, that's the magician. That's the technician. This is the person, this elite, this cognoscenti, that through understanding the secrets of nature and incantations, whatever it is, can rise above all of this and see prime matter for what it is. Now, not prime matter in Aristotle's sense, but prime matter in the alchemical sense. Now, that is a perversion of reality. It stands, the tradition, the perennial philosophy stands to that in the same way that aristocracy stands to oligarchy, or monarchy stands to tyranny. They sound similar. The same thing as the communal stands to the collective. They both, from a distance, appear to be similar, but they're not. Now, you hear this from a lot of, you know, Americans, a lot of American conservatives and liberals that agree on a lot of things. They'll say that there's only two entities, the individual and the collective, and there is nothing else. And of course, somehow, they want to square that with the revolutionary ideology of individualism. Revolutions are based not so much on mass discontent, but on one faction of the oligarchy at war with who currently rules, believing that it doesn't have the share of power that it deserves. So, given all this, the cash value of all of this is that any claim to equality is a lie. Democracy is based on a fraud. Democracy and equality, they have to both be true at the same time. The rights of the individual, so-called, and on the other hand, the will of the people, so-called, can exist at the same time. It is, you know, the will of the people is merely the mass man. It has nothing to do with truth, has nothing to do with right, has nothing to do with anything. Really has more to do with media manipulation than anything else. But then the individual right, this abstraction that apparently everyone possesses to do and say what they please so long as the regime doesn't get upset by it, can exist at the same time as the will of the people. There has to be something else. If you don't believe in any foundations, if you believe in this nominalistic, mechanical, positivist world, then all you have is the will of the mass. Politics, governments don't make any sense unless you have estates or castes. Classes, in the true sense, classes, they do not refer to income. They refer to property only secondarily. And this is one of the reasons I brought up John Adams. I did my senior thesis at Hartford on John Adams and his conception of property. Because in order for there to be a legitimate aristocracy, a group of people who have the time and the leisure and the ability and the linguistic knowledge to study political science in depth, like we're doing right here, they have to have the property. They have to have a source of financing that makes them independent. That's why property is very important. I mean, even of all people, even Leon Trotsky finally understood, as perverse as he was, he finally understood that when the party controls property, that means it controls thought. Any aristocracy, even in the Jeffersonian sense, we've dealt with that before too, has to be based on the fact that you can't have your source of income taken away if you irritate the wrong people. Because if that's the case, whether it be in Soviet Marxism or modern capitalism, you can't be independent by definition. Now, the so-called rights of the individual in the vulgar sense is what of the will of the people. It's the same thing. These are perversions of something far more important. The person is not the ego. The mass is not the population. How does Hegel, how does anyone reconcile this confrontation that liberalism can't get beyond? You have an I, and then you have an everyone else. you have my group, then you have everyone else within one society. And in a very trite way, Frank says the I and you are reconciled only in the we, which is not a collective, which is not the will of the people, not even in Rousseau's sense. It's what we might call some variation of an ethnic and linguistic nation. This is what Fichte said. This is what Hegel said. This was the German idealistic reaction to what had come before from the French Revolution. Part of the reconciliation of these options, and this goes whether it be metaphysics, ontology, or politics, starts with service. To transcend the I means you have to start doing things that don't have any remunerative value. But you do it because it's your duty to do it. You know, Aristotle defined virtue as not merely doing the right thing, but not having doing the right thing be a burden. That, in fact, you take pleasure in it. That's the highest level of virtue. Most of us do the right thing because, you know, we have to. Either we internally were driven to do it or we're afraid of consequences. But the goal is to do the right thing without any, with actually, and having it be a pleasure. To serve the interests of the we without having it be taking away from what you want and your desires in that case. Egos, eyes, even collectives. Collectives are just a bunch of eyes that have been thrown together by force. Egos can never be the foundation of anything, at least in part because they're artificial. The ego, the I, was the creation of industrialization. It had to destroy estates to render everything just one formless mass. This is why oligarchy and aristocracy are not just different from one another, but they're opposites. They only have surface qualities in common. No institution, no matter how informal, can function while the ego is untrammeled. Nothing can function with the will to power in Nietzsche's sense. Society functions, government, justice, anything can come into existence only when the ego is limited. So we talked about the metaphysics of this, now you talk about the politics of this. You have A and you have not A. You have the individual, you have this mass of the population. What is a synthesis? The I and you are manifest in the we, which is the all. When you don't see a foreigner in people around you, this is why ethnicity and religion, race, all of these things are so important. Service can only come into existence when you see yourself in others. This is why we're willing to die for our families, but maybe not for the family up the street. That's different if we all have the most foundational things in common. The A and the not A can only exist. Logic can only exist when there is a whole that you can, that joins the two together. That there's an object that you study, there's everything else. They're reconciled in the fact that you have this substratum of existence, substance in Spinoza's sense, we talked about the last time. This is also why religion has always been the foundation of every society that's ever existed. The word culture, of course, implies that. That's what the culture is. It's a spiritual unity that brings everyone together. No society can be based on its opposite. Religion has always been the foundation of society. So you have the A, you have the not A. You have the I, you have the mass or the collective. You also have, and then you have monarchy, you have tyranny. You have oligarchy, you have aristocracy. These things that only from a distance appear to be similar, but in fact, they're not. Then there's power and authority. I've made the claim about the difference between power and authority for a very long time, and it comes from Simeon Frank. Power is simply the ability to force someone to do something. You could even get more abstract. It's simply force one object to another. Authority is something very different. Authority is the right to power. It's the correct possession and usage of power. Power is simply abstract. And not everyone is attracted to it. Authority, when someone says that I'm an authority on Russian politics or I'm an authority on something, No one says, that doesn't imply you have power over it. Being an authority on something means you have an in-depth knowledge of it, that you master it in one form or another. That's why these two, and they're used synonymously all the time, which is an error. You also, you know, aristocracy and oligarchy are used synonymously too, all the time. Without any comprehension, concept of class or estate is reduced to money and the pursuit of money, which exists only in the most perverse societies. As society is dying, as the ego then takes it upon itself to do as it pleases without limit, then aristocracy becomes an oligarchy. Authority implies hierarchy. But the hierarchy can only be legitimate if it's within a specific area. And politics is just one specific area, economics. There's a hierarchy. And even if you make a claim, this is one of the things that you know, we talked about, that making an argument in favor of egotism is self-contradictory. Because in making the argument, you're using logic, and you're using language, and you're using ideas, and you're using assumptions that you had nothing to do with. These are communal possessions. So you have to use communal possessions to argue against the use of communal possessions. It's not just a contradiction, it's an inherent contradiction. So even if you make the argument to equality, if you're one of these people who somehow believes in the full equality of everything, there's a handful of utopian theorists over the years who have thought that. That's all I've read a long time ago. My master's advisor was one of the world's sergeant, one of the world's authorities on utopianism. There's a few who that believe, and everyone gets a credit card at the beginning of every year, has the same amount of money on it. It's non-transferable, whatever. There's been a few, mostly in literature, that believe in this. But someone who's an authority in that sense, someone who has to argue this point and take care of all of its fine points, logically and every other way, if that's possible, still then is above all the people who he claims are equal to him. It's an inherent contradiction. An organization that uses violence to demand equality doesn't make any sense. The very idea of a vanguard party, like Lenin talked about, is a contradiction, because you can't be a vanguard party. The handful of the enlightened ones who are going to bring everyone to equality while claiming to be a vanguard of enlightened ones. So the imposition of equality denies equality's existence. It can't be, because you're imposing it. You have a clearer conception of it than everyone else, and therefore you're not equal. He does have a conception. Now, the social law is that authority, in other words, legitimacy, is only for the few. In the same sense that, you know, lung surgery is the domain only of the few, those who have authority in the area. I could go into a hospital right now and cut someone up. I don't have any authority. I don't have the power to do that. I don't have the authority to do that. Authority relies on hierarchy, because there are some people who know how to operate on different organs much better than others. You know, every field has its legendary people. And this, you know, even, you know, there is a strand of liberalism that does actually believe this, that inequality is justified only within a field. Someone will, you know, accuse me of thinking, you know, someone's better than someone else. Well, the question, the way you answer that is to ask another question. Well, better in what sense? There's no abstract better. There's no abstract supremacy. In what area are you referring to? Then it starts making sense. And it makes sense because for every office, for every field, there are a very specific set of rules. There are examples of success. There are examples of failure. That doesn't exist abstractly. Because we're human beings, it only exists in a very specific, very tiny sliver of reality. We know what a good running back is versus a bad one. The meritocracy is very clear. The standards are very clear. No one really challenges it. You have superiority in that area, both in qualitative and quantitative modes. All of a sudden, aristocracy, inequality, the famous 80-20 rule of Pareto, which is really hard to deny, comes into existence when you talk about a very specific field. That's when you start talking about authority. Now, of course, Frank lived through the revolution. It was a miracle that he, like, you know, Berdyaev and many others, were not killed. But he spends a lot of time talking about revolution. And I've hinted already that there's this Gnostic foundation to revolution. Because all revolutionaries, from the British so-called Glorious Revolution, to the French Revolution, to the Soviet Revolution, revolutions in Turkey, the Sun Yat-sen in China, the Cultural Revolution in America in the 20th century, these have all been based on violence, of course, but they're also based on a group of people who honestly believe that they have discovered this substratum, this foundation, the key to history. Capitalism, of course, has always been a violently revolutionary ideology. It destroyed, in Britain and Northern Europe, the beginning of modernity. It destroyed the guild. It destroyed the cottage industry. It destroyed the extended family. It forced everyone into cities and created what Leontief would call the satanic chaos, the satanic mills. There's no slavery that can be considered remotely worse than what it was like to work in a factory in 18th century Britain. Or what it was like to be a chimney sweep, which is a little kid who got tied to a pole and was used to scrub out the inside of a chimney. Most of them died very young, usually of some variation of cancer. This is a foundation of modernity. This is a satanic system that Leontief saw, that Thomas Carlyle saw, that many of the... But the revolution, in the Marxist sense, and even much of the anarchist sense, is not so much that this was a bad thing, since they can't make truth claims or moral claims. Marx never said right or wrong. This is simply how it was. Because all he saw were atoms in motion. You could even read his doctoral dissertation where he says the same thing. No, it's merely based on the idea that rather than making a certain percentage of the value of a product, they need to possess the full value of the product. And it goes no farther than that, at least on paper. But it does have this, both capitalism and communism, both have this Gnostic foundation, the key to history to be found in production. And that means that the natural world doesn't really exist. Just like for Darwin, Darwin never believed in species, despite the title of his book. Species were just a temporary name for something that's always going to change. It may take a long time to change, but it's always going to change. This alchemical substratum, the philosopher's stone, the quicksilver, mercury that can be used to dilute and destroy the specific qualities of things, leaving you with the flux, leaving you with something that possesses no qualities. Now, I challenge you to consider something that possesses no qualities. It is impossible. It's like trying to picture a color by itself. You can't do that. It has to be a color of something. It can never just be by itself. But that's the foundation of both ideologies. And both ideologies are revolutionary in the sense that everything, therefore, now is reduced to matter, cause and effect, mechanism, and dominating this process consciously and bringing it, forcing nature to give far more than it's capable of giving. The Russian tradition, everyone from Skovorod to Leontief, always, it is the so-called primitivists, you have a handful of anarchists who talk like this, that God and nature give just as much as we need. We don't need to force things. There are two different types of technology. There's one type of technology that works with the natural order, like a water wheel or something like that, even the old windmills. The other type of technology that just doesn't seem to work with nature, but wants to dominate it, wants to replace it, the Judaic tikkun olam, or to fix the world, that the world somehow is inherently incorrect. The demiurge, or what they would say, the God of the Old Testament, created a faulty, unbalanced world, and it's up to us to fix it and to bring it to fruition. And that's precisely the foundation of the revolutions. Revolution, by definition, is a modern conception, because a revolution isn't a revolution unless you have this perverted idea of what this substratum is. It's still material, but it's matter without qualities. It's matter just as such. And even the modern scientific revolution has a bit of that. In my very first conference presentation, I was still in grad school, was on McKnight and the series of experts in the Renaissance who saw modern technology as deriving directly from the Medici Renaissance alchemy. It's just a Gnostic religious idea that has been rationalized and called industry and technology. What revolutions create, though, is a much harsher oligarchy, for lack of a better term, that never had existed before. Again, you can't impose equality or utopia at the barrel of a gun. You know, even the so-called founder of modern Greece, Venizelos, claimed to be the demiurge of Greece. You have this Masonic idea all over the place, and it's based on a contradiction. You can impose equality or justice at the barrel of a gun. This is something that simply has to develop naturally. But beyond that, you know, he defines the idea of theophany as this revelation of the duality between spirit and world. But he does deny, and Berdyaev says the same thing, they really can't be balanced. They correspond to theological, well, essentially it is the basis of heresy. Arianism or Nestorianism is based on this dualism that they never reconcile. This, of course, leads to the monstrous doctrine of the separation of church and state. When Lenin began his persecution of the Orthodox Church in Russia, his decree was entitled On the Separation of Church and State. That implies that not only is religious doctrine cannot be a part of public life, but any idealistic conception can't be a part of public life, because ultimately it all comes from a religious background. And the American Constitution, of course, as everything, it's been perverted, and today doesn't make a lot of sense, but the idea of a rejection of the establishment of religion, first of all, permitted states to establish religion, but it simply meant that the state simply can't finance one sect at the federal government, I should say, can't finance one sect at the expense of everything else. That's all it meant. It had nothing to do with banning religion, which, of course, is the case now. Capitalism demands this because there can't be anything in between the mass cipher that we're supposed to be and their happiness to be found in consumption. The medium is what we today call the media, and it's not an accident that it's the same term. The media. That's what determines what reality is and what it's not. Revolution is, in Frank's sense, the substitute for a spiritual life, a substitute for this true substratum of everything, the spiritual world, the spiritual all that we all have to, that natural all comes from, and ultimately where consciousness comes from, or consciousness, in fact, manifests. Any law, and I'm talking about positive law here, can only be judged on whether or not it protects the society from evil. But of course, evil also has to be defined. Don't forget, we live in an era of partial birth abortion. Something just came up recently concerning that. I mean, you could see the puncture marks in the back of the neck of these, you know, fully, you know, babies at full term. So evil has to be defined. And it isn't so much that you're going to have people saying, yes, let's kill the babies, but they'll simply deflect. They'll talk about something else entirely so as to avoid actually dealing with this. So it isn't so much that they're rational, but they are involved in rationalization. Two very, very different things. We did mention Nikolai Berdyaev. Now, I've had several lectures on him and his criticism. And I'm, Berdyaev always has been a problem for me. I've been reading him my whole adult life. Not recently, but since I've been dealing with Frank recently, he's come up. He was an admirer of Frank, but like so many others, that Christian existentialism that he promoted is based on the total opposite of what Frank is dealing with. Frank says that ontology comes before anything else. The slogan the existentialists use is that existence comes before essence. And of course, Frank says the exact opposite. What that slogan means, you see it in Sartre, you even see it in a different sense in Heidegger. Existence comes before essence is to say that human freedom, the act of will, based on nothing But the will itself is not based on anything that actually exists. It's not based on a substratum, whether it be material or not. That the substratum is, in fact, the projection of the disordered mind. That's the basis of existentialism. And Berdyaev is not shy about talking, and he criticizes Frank on this ground. Berdyaev says, where is freedom in this idea? If ontology comes first, if essence comes first, then what are we talking about in terms of freedom? And over the centuries, the question of free will within the system like this, the Hegelian system, Marx rejected free will as such, but that was based on mechanism and nothing else. We also talked about Spinoza. We talked about all of these holistic systems that the existentialists like Berdyaev had railed against. And the answer, at least part of the answer, beyond Spinoza, comes from Schelling, the leaders of German idealism, who died in 1854, so the middle of the 19th century. And he also deals with the whole question of the subconscious. The dead nature that John Locke had always projected onto the world, that nature only matters and only is anything when someone will make something out of it. You cut down a tree, you make bookshelves out of it. The tree in itself is nothing. You can't even call it a tree. It only becomes something when you chop it down and you make it into something that you need. That's the idea of nature being dead, which is at the root of the revolution of capitalism. Deadness, though, for someone like Schelling, is the subconscious. As legitimate science progresses, things being unveiled, I'm not talking about the modern scientific establishment, but science in its true sense, in its ancient and medieval sense, develops. That which was subconscious then becomes conscious. So Schelling, and this is years before this, says that you can't make an argument, as the existentialist will later do, much later do. I'm being anachronistic here, but it does work. And even in Spinoza, years earlier. Freedom can't come from freedom. So while Berdyaev may criticize Frank on this, on the grounds that freedom coming from ontology, coming from essence coming before existence, is against the free will, he has a problem. And I've said this already, that how can the will be based on the will? Something has to exist to do the willing. Berdyaev, the existentialist answer, of course, is that the ontology is a creation of the will in the first place. And Schopenhauer and a lot of others said that. But Schelling, and I mention him only because of his importance in the first half of the 19th century in rejecting the materialist and mechanistic conception of the world. But the claim is that freedom is not something indeterminate. Freedom certainly exists. But it's the will being caused by something that is fully understood. Freedom isn't based on freedom. There are causes. But so long as you're aware of these causes, why you've chosen what you've chosen, and trace it back as far as humanly possible, that itself, that is a free choice. The libertarian idea of the free will is an absurdity. And that's not just in Frank, but a lot of people, Hegel being one of them, Spinoza, and Schelling, importantly, even Fichte. I shouldn't say Fichte. But, and of course, many of these are just responses to Kant, that it's only the subconscious that is mechanized, that's indeterminate. Once it becomes conscious, it's now free. The free will is based on causes that we fully understand. We go into something with our eyes wide open. Necessity, which is the opposite of freedom, of course, is not just a dead mechanism, but it's the realization of the absolute, the realization of God's will and understanding where this comes from and why it's important. You can't have the will based on the will. Will has to be based on something far more important and have an aim. The problem with the existentialists is the will is based on the will. A free will without cause, for what purpose? So where did that purpose come from? It has to be based on the substratum of being. And this, tore philosophy apart for 200 years. And actually, Schelling also, make the distinction between philosophy and power. Maintaining one's place in the rational order of being is not only the nature of freedom, but also the nature of justice. And this is something that, you know, liberals, existentialists will rail against from here on in. But there is one thing that, you know, Frank, the intuitivist, the Schelling and Berdyaev all agree with and agree on. And that's the negation of philosophy itself coming from the bourgeoisie, coming from what we might want to call the middle classes, the revolutionary managerial class of, in this point, you know, the middle of modern capitalism. The bourgeoisie doesn't seek meaning, it seeks stability in things. This is something that Frank and Berdyaev will always agree on. Objects aren't really objects because science doesn't deal with objects. Science deals with meaning. It deals with concepts. That in the middle class, the dead middle class world, the bourgeoisie, the mystic, the prophet, the truth, in fact, doesn't have a place. They are idolaters. They project all of their anxieties and passions onto the world, and objects become the only thing that they understand, the only thing worth having. There is no natural law. Everything is conventional. Everything is based on this mutual agreement, whatever is good for business. The accident or the quality of objects, the quantity, is the only thing that matters. Number rules everything. They have no conception of the communal. They have no conception of nature as anything but mere cause and effect that industry should interrupt and dominate. They don't understand sacramental grace. They understand only magic. The difference between magic and the sacrament is that magic, like technology, forces itself on the natural order. It forces nature to do something that it normally wouldn't do. Where, for example, C.S. Lewis, in his book on miracles, said really a miracle is nothing more than the natural order just sped up a little bit. Now, Christ made wine out of water. Well, wine comes from water. The Eucharist, where the bread and wine becomes the body and blood of Christ. Well, that makes a lot of sense, because the pregnant woman eating bread, that part of it will turn into the baby. Bread does turn into people all the time. The miracle, the sacramental order, is just the natural order sped up by grace, the creator of all things. That's not what magic is. Marxism, capitalism, that bourgeois, that dead bourgeois element, only understands magic to force the imposition of the will on everything. Which is why Protestantism was the official religion of the bourgeoisie as it came into existence in Northern Europe. Nominalism, commercialism, fragmentation, egotism, bureaucracy. This is essentially all one thing that comes from the negation of the perennial philosophy. The things that Frank and Solovyov and Hegel and Schelling talked about. That despite their differences, Berdyaev and Frank will certainly agree on the nature of the bourgeoisie as a negation of all of these things. The negation of all meaning, the negation of all truth, the negation of all philosophy, and certainly the negation of all religion. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.